Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is a piece called Dark Rooms that was a part of the competition at Venice Immersive 2025. So this is a virtual reality piece where you're going in and exploring these dark rooms. These dark rooms are these kind of non-conventional sexual explorations for these different communities, and you kind of get embodied into a bit of a spatial storytelling of these stories. And it's very much told through these characters, so it's based upon these oral history interviews. And from those oral history interviews, they collaborated in being able to create spatial representations of their lives. And so it was very much a co-creative process that they used within their main protagonists. So you see like three or four different stories and you kind of go from one space to the next, but it really feels like you're kind of walking through the story in a way that you're able to explore. So it's like three people at the same time and you have this space, but you're able to kind of walk through almost as a guided tour, go through it. So yeah, that's the main gist of the story. So the main contextual domains is that it's these alternative and non-conformative sexualities that are usually hidden or taboo, and you're exploring these cultures of these dark rooms, as well as the connection to their own personal identity, but also the past and various familial traumas. So you watch both as an invisible ghost, but there are also some moments where you're embodied as a character to mimic being a part of this alternative culture. So the main center of gravity of this piece is the earth element in terms of the embodied and environmental presence. And so you're very much immersed yourself into the spatial architecture of these dark rooms. And you're mostly a ghostly observer, but sometimes you do actually switch into being an embodied role as a character that you kind of role play, getting out on your knees and mimicking similar actions that you would be going through if you were actually a part of some of these communities. So it's more to embody the form rather than to fully participate as a character within the story. So you're still mostly like a ghost-like character, and more to invoke your own sense of embodied memories than for you to truly participate and engage, since everything's like pre-recorded. So the spatial transitions and the overall spatial journey that you're taking on in this piece was one of the best jobs that I've seen. Just the way that they're able to kind of mash these worlds together and go from one scene to the next, it really felt like kind of an editing or mashing up of spatial context. You can imagine something like Meow Wolf that does a great job of kind of mashing these spatial contexts together. And so it kind of felt like going from one space to the next, and you're kind of seamlessly walking into these other realms. So it's really quite alluring how they're able to do this kind of spatial editing. And the transitions in this piece were absolutely incredible. And so there's a bit of the cinematic quality because of that, because you feel like you have a rhythm and a pacing that feels like you're walking through these spaces that feels similar to like seeing a very well-edited film. And that's kind of what it felt like, as you sometimes were walking through the space or sometimes you were being moved through the space. And so there's different ways that they're either having you directly locomote or have you be locomoted through to go from one space to the next. So the second center of gravity for me is the water element in terms of the stories that are being told, but also like this sense of time of going through these journeys and the beginning, middle, and end of exploring each of these different stories and each of these different worlds, because each of the worlds are connected to each of the stories that are unfolding. And so I did have this like sense of awe and wonder and excitement as I'm exploring in these kind of more taboo or hidden aspects of alternative, non-conformative sexualities. But I'm mostly kind of listening to the testimony of these stories from these main protagonists as they're talking about their memories and traumatic memories, but in a way that is kind of like walking through a bit of a spatial film. So there is very much a cinematic quality overall to the piece in terms of the type of pacing and editing and the way that they're modulating and playing with space and time. And also with these kind of montage of memories that you're seeing. So you're going to these different spatial representations of these, but it feels like a little bit of a montage sequence as you're taking all these things in. And then the third center of gravity is the fire element in terms of your own agency, participation. Again, there's no narrative agency, but you are walking through the spatial architecture as the story is unfolding. And so there are some instances where you do become a character and you do have a chance to move your body relative to those instructions that are given, but you're also just kind of like moving your body through the space and you're kind of exploring around. So it definitely creates a sense of wandering that I think a number of different pieces back at Venice Immersive 2025 were trying to recreate this sense of you being able to kind of freely explore to a certain extent. And also you have a limited amount of physical space, but also these are very tightly bound spaces and there's a couple of people in there at the same time as you are. And so you have to kind of negotiate walking around them as well as seeing what you want to see, because there are some moments for you to kind of explore around on your own to kind of see these different spaces. And it's a bit of the environmental storytelling to learn about the story by looking at the environment. And then the final center of gravity of the presence is the air element, in terms of most of this is through voiceover narration. And so, you know, there are some moments where they have more volumetrically captured moments where they're sharing, but for the most part, it's this voiceover where you're hearing most of these memories kind of overlay these different montage sequences and flashbacks as you're learning about this person. So the voiceover is primarily how you're receiving the majority of the story. And also there is this kind of social dimension of the air element. So it did allow three people to see it at the same time. And so you did see other people as avatars who are also exploring these worlds. And then at the end, there was actually this kind of like more air element, AI-driven offboarding with a large language model that I personally wasn't as much of a fan of, just because it didn't seem like it was, you know, really understanding or interpreting. It just kept asking me questions and I just found myself kind of talking at it and they had to cut me off because it wasn't really coming to an end. And I'm not sure if it necessarily made me feel like I was able to articulate the full richness of my experience. I think it might've been better served to be able to do that with another person, but there was a bit of an experimentation to see like, to what degree can you have artificial intelligence and like an AI chatbot to perhaps help people offboard of an experience like this. And especially if people are having a hard time, I'd be even more hesitant to see that be left up to a large language model that could potentially make whatever thing might be coming up even worse. So for me, I'm a little bit more of a minimalist when it comes to the use of AI and large language models. But I know that Mods is someone who's like, he was one of the producers of the About a Hero and did an interview with him as well. And then he was also at the IFA Doc Lab later on after this, doing this kind of towards an ethical standards for artificial intelligence workshop. So yeah, it was a bit of an experiment to see to what degree that might or might not work. So some of the different archetypal characters that are being explored is, from their statements, is, quote, exploration of human psychology through the prism of sexuality, especially through these, quote, queer and non-comparative sexualities. And it also intends to, quote, step into the heart of human desire and the shadows it casts. And then also, quote, to wish to open the doors to darker spaces of our protagonist's sexuality. So there's a lot of like embodied and radical consent that's also being done with the context of this process, where their participants had at any moment they could withdraw their consent as to whether or not the story would be aired or not. And so really giving co-creative control with the people that they're participating in, and to be able to really engender this kind of co-creative process to the extreme, to the point where if they wanted to at the night before the premiere, they could say that they didn't want their piece and they would take it out. So kind of like a radical levels of consent that they're also exploring within the context of this piece, which I think is also really interesting. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Mods and Steen happened on Saturday, August 30th, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So I'm Mads Damsbo and I'm a former XR creator, a producer, creator, but now transitioned into director here with Dark Rooms together with Lauritz that's sitting next to me.
My name is Lauritz Flensted Jensen, and I'm directing together with Mass. And I actually come from making feature films and documentary, and we teamed up creating this project together. Yeah.
Great. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to each of your backgrounds and your journey into the space.
Sure. I guess my journey is from the producing standpoint, so being interested in the technology for so long since it, like the DK1 came out, and just exploring and experimenting as much as I could. Produced many works, including like The Doghouse, which was quite famous at the time, The End of Night, that one here in Venice a few years ago, and a whole lot of experiments in between that's been around festivals. So I come from a very sort of, I guess that you could call me like an OG in the XR space, if that's something.
Yeah, and I direct feature films, and I have a background as a documentary director. I graduated from the National Film School 10 years ago, National Film School of Denmark. And I'm always looking for more experimental work to be done. And I think my background as a documentary filmmaker led me into this field, because what I love about like creating documentaries, and what I love about the process of creating documentaries, is that you can really go on a journey of exploration. And this is also what actually led me into the collaboration with Mass, that we wanted to see how we could like explore the medium together in a documentary path.
Yeah, and it's a really powerful piece of storytelling. I'm really looking forward to unpacking it, because it does seem like there's an anchor of the audio oral history interviews that then are kind of recreated in VR in various different ways. But maybe we could just take a step back and you can tell me, like, where did this project of Dark Rooms begin?
Yeah, I think we both come at it from a little bit different places, but it definitely, for me, comes from, at the time of the conception of the piece, a very sort of honest and naive and clear path of exploring my own sexuality at the time, and going and actually meeting Dark Room for the first time in a late age, I would say. I'm 40 now, and like I had no idea this whole community existed. And so I think for me that was just like such a inviting space and much more inclusive and colorful and special than I imagined. And the people I met in and around Dark Room spaces were very fascinating. And so for me that was like a first step in, and then Lauritz had his own path, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, my curiosity started by exploring role plays in my own private life with a then partner, and I found that these role plays were actually a very liberating way of accessing something in yourself, experience that you could accommodate, experiences that you could actually go through in a kind of go into in a very therapeutic way. And this was my way into Dark Rooms. And then me and Mads, we started sitting down and talking about exchanging these different experiences we had, and talked about how we could conceptualize a project that would have this as a core, like sexuality and love and identity. Yeah.
So I'm not familiar with the word dark rooms, but I am familiar with, say, like kink or BDSM or non-conforming sexual practices. I'm just curious, if you were to describe what a dark room is, how would you describe it?
Yeah, it's funny because I think actually the title is a little bit culturally specific. I think in Berlin you would call it a play space or a playroom. So it has different names. But a dark room, at least from the Danish culture side, like it literally is a dark room in a club or in a venue that is sex positive, and where it's sort of like a rule that the moment you step into the dark room, that anything can happen. I mean, you've already given consent by the fact of you walking in. Of course, you still have, you know, you can say no in there and you can step out at any time, but you're kind of going into a sexual space where anything is possible. And I think importantly, you don't know or see yourself or anyone else in there. You just feel and listen and smell and touch.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the title has different connotations, and we gave it the title Dark Rooms also to allow like the psychological dimension, which is very much what Dark Rooms is as well, because it's different tales, and it's all these different tales that might be difficult to talk about. And that's what we wanted to have. Like, we wanted to be able to give the audience an experience that led to a more open conversation about these topics, themes.
Yeah, and there seems to be a way that you're telling a story that is very like biographical and connecting the dots between their past, maybe some traumatic events that maybe lead to their preferences sexually. But I'm just curious, as you were planning this out, where did you begin in terms of, like, was it like an interview process of just doing audio interviews and then from there doing volumetric capture and then building out the scene? And I know there's always like an iterative process of like building out and then maybe going back to audio, but just curious to hear like the starting point for where you started with Dark Rooms.
Well, the starting point was that we did an open call. So we started inviting people to send in stories, and then we did pre-interviews with them to select people who could be right to get the right representation for the project. And then actually what we set up as a framework for the entire project was that we invited all the participants to co-create the projects together with us. So we did do these master interviews in the beginning, but from then on, there was a long process of involving the participants, both in creating the story arc, but also creating the visual world that the audience would go through.
Yeah, and I think maybe a good time now is to explain the difference between Lauritz and my role, and the reason why we are two directors, which I think really worked well in this piece, other than the fact that we also had, of course, Anne-Sophie, who's also on the credit here as a director, who was very much conceptually part of the structure and the casting, and is such a great capacity. But Lauritz and I, maybe more as the hands-on directors, had different roles where Lauritz is a documentarist, and so he was conducting the interviews and making sort of sure that, you know, his approach and method to get near to a truth or to some core of the story was taken advantage of, and we really got far with that. And then my role was more to sort of interpret and design and facilitate the immersive design of how will we then actually unfold and unpack this story for the audience. And so that was kind of also our role differences in the piece. And as Lauritz said, once the participants were involved, they became directors as well to sort of come with their input. And I think most importantly, it was about also trying to not only just understand on a intellectual level what they were saying, but also to understand on a very physical level what that meant, you know. So what does it mean to be a puppy in Trixie's dog yard, and actually playing along and so having play sessions with Trixie to sort of show us what is it to be hounded around and go on your knees. And that really helped us to sort of then design a space that felt real and embodied for that story.
Yeah, I really love the dreamlike quality of the piece, where it feels like you're walking through a dream and from scene to scene. And also a lot of these, you know, coming from the more esoteric UFO community of like UFO sightings, there's a lot of like floating orbs and lights that gives this illusion of like this otherworldly experience Mods is just showing me his UFO tattoo on his right arm. So yeah, there's a lot of this, you know, sighting or experiencer of the phenomenon in the piece that I guess is kind of also maybe alluding to like an otherworldly quality that maybe are part of our own lives that are hidden or occluded or exiled and maybe taboo to talk around. And so, yeah, just curious to hear around like these visual metaphors of the orbs and the kind of UFO quality that the piece kind of is a through line throughout the entirety of the piece.
I really love that you mentioned this UFO part. It wasn't intentional for it to have that association. I think the light that you see across the experience that also sort of gives it this dreamy quality was very much based on the concept of exposure. So like, how do we go, if we go into unknown territory, which was the first tagline, what does that mean? You know, I remember you said it's like walking into the game, was it Settlers or this other game where you have a dark map and you have to explore and you uncover the map.
Civilization. The second Civilization game, yeah.
The first time you had this map that was completely in darkness, and then you had to sort of explore and open up a world and be more and more exposed. And so we use that as a very sort of common thread to say, well, how can light suddenly open up new paths or show us new things? And even we can help, you know, by shining a flashlight or, you know, walking into a space and sort of opening a door or whatever. And I think that was really fundamental. And then what we had to do, of course, is we had to sort of construct some kind of logic of like, where are we going and how does this whole layout look for the spaces? So we ended up drawing a huge map similar to like a world map of a game where you had like the forest where the first scenes happen, and then the train, and the train takes you to that station, but then the station takes you to this elevator and that takes you to that thing, and then you go up here but you're still under the ground, and like, so it kind of all has some weird logic based on this kind of map, and you also end up in the same crater like structure that you saw from the very beginning, so it's all sort of one big map.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just a comment that is coming up associated to that is just the installation and the way that just from the very beginning, there's a hole that's cut out in the wall that says, don't peek. And of course, you know, the first thing I do is peek and to see what's in there because I'm curious. I want to know what's in there. So there's this peep show quality of like a voyeur looking into a world that feels foreign or taboo and giving permission to go into that. But walking into a dark room, taking off our shoes, there's like graffiti written over everywhere into the installation that has like quotes from the piece that are alluding to it, priming you, but also a bit of an onboarding process of making sure that it's safe, but also just a lot of instructions to prepare the audience members here at Venice to go into this, what feels like a bit of an initiatory experience where we're being initiated into a world that we might not otherwise have access or permission to go into, or at least like a ghost go in and observe and kind of leave without a trace. So yeah, just curious to hear a little bit more around the experiential design of the installation to prime people to go into this experience?
I mean, I think there were there was a lot of key scenes where we wanted to give you this physical embodiment of the experience and go over stepping over small boundaries, like when you're going down to the water. It's actually causing you a little bit of it makes people a little bit nervous to go down there, and I think that's a very good like portal that you have to move through. And there are a couple of these portals along the way that really makes you feel more in the experience and in the body of the participants, the storytellers. And what became like a leading thread of the concept for us was all the participants were talking about play as a way of dealing with difficult emotions or traumatic events. And this became like, okay, how can we integrate these small plays for the audience to play along with the participants? Yeah,
and I think it's funny, right? Because play space is also what we call the area that you have a VR experience in. But there's something about dark rooms and VR play spaces that actually also marry really well, because there is in dark rooms this need to set the rules straight, right? When you go into a space like that, you have to have your expectations in order. You have to know the sort of code of conduct. You have to have agreements, basically, about what happens if something goes wrong or something goes too far. So this negotiation between people that are entering into, or between you and a space, is really fundamental for dark rooms. And so, in many ways, this is exactly what happens in any VR experience, is that as a designer, creator, and as experience designer, you have to sort of make sure your audience know a little bit of what they're getting into and what we're agreeing to. What do I do if something fails? You know, what can I do, not do? But at the same time, allowing them the freedom in a safe way to really explore.
Yeah, we talked a little bit around the world-building process and the map, but I'd love to get back to kind of like the development of the interviews and the story arcs and this collaboration with each of the characters. It sounds like that's a lot of what you were working on in terms of like doing the master primary interviews. Just love to hear a little bit more around this more iterative process of like kind of inviting in the subjects of the interview subjects to be co-creators and to help to imagine these scenes that they're maybe talking around, and just if some of this had come out through the process of the interview, or if it was a back and forth between having them into more of a speculative space of imagining what they would want to do, to what feels like in some ways like a revisiting of core memories of people that they may have, and to have it reenacted spatially, and then yeah, if they were able to do that and then experience it and then take the story on. But yeah, just curious to hear about that iterative process with the subjects of both capturing their story, but also help inviting them in to co-develop their stories.
Sure. I mean, I think every time you create a documentary, you also create an ethical dilemma for yourself. And I've been doing documentary for so many years, I always find it very interesting to approach this perspective of ethics, to ask yourself, why am I allowed to tell these stories? What gives me the right? And in this process, that's why we designed it like this. And I mean, it makes the process a lot more difficult. And I mean, usually you would invite your participants in a lot later in the process to kind of sign off on the story. But here we invited them in very early, and we did follow-up interviews, and we played the interviews for them and asked for their feedback, even though that sometimes they would ask us to take things out or add things or make the story longer. And that was it was a very tough process, because it was so difficult to actually to keep the stories, also to keep the bigger picture and make all these strings tie together, and still actually listen to the feedback that we received and really go along like, okay, but we have to take this seriously, because this is the concept we set up for ourselves. So I think that friction, kind of friction, gave a lot to the process. And most important of all, it also made us feel more safe in what we were doing, actually.
Yeah, because we had this parole we used, you know, nothing about us without us, which I think is a very strong thing to remind yourself of. But also the fact that the actual structure of the legal structure of how we included them is also that they didn't sign off from the beginning like you would normally do. The structure is that they can pull at any moment, because this is their story, and so if they don't want to show it, you know, an hour before opening in Venice, in theory, they could kill it, right? And so that requires an extreme amount of trust between us as the creators and them as the participants. And that trust is something you have to earn through communicating and through sharing the process. And of course, the more they knew about our process, it became easier for them to understand, you know, why we were doing what we were doing or deciding the way we wanted to design. So yeah.
Yeah, and this is also where Anne-Sophie, who is the one of the like the third creators of the project, her work was very like core to this process, because she has a she specialized as an intimacy coordinator, and she would have like private conversations with our participants without involving me and Mass, so they could actually tell her things that maybe we were not allowed to ever know. Or they could ask to have a conversation with her if there was some kind of emotional boundary that they felt insecure about before they started sharing in an interview. So, I mean, this also gave a lot to the process of co-creation. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, should we tell the story? I mean, it's quite obvious to say that there was a very specific moment where that manifested itself when... We in the final story, without giving much away, it's a story of Ya Lioness, was antagonized by white male police officers. And the problem was that she was telling a story about being a little bit afraid, not a little bit, but quite afraid of white males and the power dynamic between authority and her. And suddenly we as two white male directors sitting in a room trying to get a story out of her felt like it was mirroring the same dynamic that she was really triggering on, right? And so from the conversations she was having with Anne-Sophie, we realized that, or she realized, that she had to sort of change that power dynamic to actually move on with us, which meant that Lauritz and I accepted a challenge to be in a workshop with her, a physical workshop where she would control everything and dominate us.
That was a play session. We did a play session, and that's what actually came out in the piece as well. You see, as these living sculptures that appear in the last story. Yeah.
Yeah. At Doc Lab, if a Doc Lab, there's been some conversations over the years of talking around this more co-creative, shared consent models, and you know, from these communities, there's this idea of that consent could be withdrawn at any moment. So to really embody that within the co-creative process is really, legally there's not existing templates for how to exactly have the language to be able to codify that into law or in some sort of legal agreement. But you made a mention earlier of the troubles or difficulties, and I'm just remembering a recent documentary of Pee Wee as himself with Paul Rubens, where the filmmaker is documenting with the collaboration and consent, but then Paul Rubens wants to kind of take over the documentary and almost be the director of the piece, and that there could be a sense of like when you yield over too much control over to the subjects to tell their story, then they might self-edit, they might not tell the story in a way that only presents it in a way that is not authentic to the overall truth. And so there's this tension and balance, I think, of like maintaining the authenticity of for you as coming in as directors to try to preserve the authenticity of the arc of the narrative of the stories, but also allow this more open-ended collaborative process to emerge, given over some of that authorial control over how the project was going to emerge. So it sounds like that it's transformative in the way that it is covering this topic, but also the way in which it's produced. So I don't know if you have any other comments on, after going through this, how that changes the way that you think around this consent model, going beyond just like having people sign away all their authorial control over their stories in the way that documentaries have traditionally been produced, which can have a little bit of a colonial patterns of kind of seizing the story without having any recourse.
Exactly, and that's why I think it's so important to start having these conversations about. I mean, this made our project a lot more time-consuming and difficult it really challenged the process a lot, and in all departments, because when something was changing in the story, then it would also affect the 3D designers and the sound designers' work. So it was really not a wishful scenario, but I think the more people who start to create documentaries like this, accepting the trouble or the friction that follows with this process, it also helps to start having these conversations abroad, and more people start to question themselves about the ethics of documentary, and I think that's really important.
because there's no design. I mean, we didn't have a perfect design at all. There is no perfect design for this, but there is a choice whether you choose the trouble that comes along with it or you choose not to have it.
Yeah, the friction. Yeah, and I think also the... I mean, I definitely will be hesitant to just jump straight into a similar process. Maybe I'll do fiction next, which is a little bit easier. But I think what I learned from it and that I really will take with me is like this completely clear fact that I'm privileged in some ways and I have blind angles. Like I there's things I do not see from my perspective. And unless I surrender part of my perspective, I won't see it, right? I also have to embody someone else for a moment to be able to actually see the full story.
So I guess what I'm really curious around is with this more organic, emergent, collaborative process, how do you just start to put down an anchor of what to build upon in terms of the story? Was it the audio? You know, because you're also collaborating with them to generate these scenes and recreate them. And so it's split up into three different parts and they're somewhat like episodes that are all tied together in a way that they could be independent or slotted in or out or add more episodes on. But just curious to hear around this process of how you went about capturing something and then going back and forth between the story that you're capturing from the audio perspective, that's the voiceover, and then a kind of immersive design of the entire experience.
Well, actually, we did pre-interviews with all our participants, and then from that, we designed the story arc of how the different chapters would affect each other. So the first chapter was about liberation, and the next chapter was about role play, and then there was a third chapter that was supposed to be really about love as the main core of the theme. But actually that story became the story that is only in the physical installation, is not in the VR piece, because these stories also started when we then came into the productions. The story started to expand and we couldn't fit, we didn't have like enough time to fit all the stories together, so became like a redesigning process all the time. But we had, like, from the beginning, like, put it all together as like a structured piece of how the different stories would play into each other.
Yeah, and I guess they had levels of, I wouldn't say levels of taboo, but in some ways they had like levels of complexity, so they became, you know, more and more complex or challenging as you would move on. And I think also each story in itself was very different from each other, so one story would be very easy because the participant was very happy with the first edit and really loved the process and didn't have many things to say about it but just gave us a lot of trust. And other participants would be very involved and would require a lot of feedback and a lot of iterations. And so it really depends on, yeah, the participant.
Yeah, I think another really visceral experience of this piece is like being embodied as like a ghost-like avatar where there's two other people going through it at the same time. Then you have this journey that we're going on. And then the first story is a little bit of like you're watching it, you're observing it, but you're not embodied or participating in any meaningful way. But then as it progresses, then the two last chapters, you have more of an opportunity or invitation for people to kind of embody some of the different, you know, let's say, situations or contexts that people might be in and that are going to be playing out in this virtual context. That then at the end, you also have this whole like AI debriefing thing that is like quite interesting to see, like how you can start to have like a offloading process that is a large language model that's very tuned to that. But just curious to hear it around like this design of the embodied experience that you're trying to invite people to take the form and the structure of some of these different more non-conventional sexual behaviors.
Which is, of course, like a very tricky thing, right? Because one thing is interacting, participating in any kind of interactive experience. It's always going to be a little bit weird and can be a little bit like uncomfortable in some ways, right?
Speaking of that.
And so, but then adding to that, the fact that we are doing this in a darkroom setting, which has like sensitive subjects and themes, it made it also something we're very careful not to sort of throw you in the deep end from the beginning and be like, okay, let's go, let's do some whipping or something, you know? Like that's not that we really wanted you to take small steps that grew larger and larger as you went further. I think we could have gone even further to some extent, but I love the balance of like, yeah, as you also said, these portals, these consent gates that kind of ease you into having more and more embodiment in the experience. So yeah, that was very much the sort of overall thinking of it.
Yeah, and also all the time looking out for that we didn't just want to put like interaction in the stories if they wasn't connected to the theme of the story. That's also why, for example, in the second chapter in the dockyard, there's more consent gates, more interaction, and that's all built around the concept of trust, because that's like a theme in that story. So it also had to come a little bit from the storytellers, the interaction, because what our aim is, besides like getting you more immersed into the piece, is also getting you more to identify more with the participants. Like, how can we get you into their inner worlds and connect them, connect you as an audience to them? Yeah, to how to create identification.
Yeah, and the second time that I went through it, because there was a bit of a technical glitch that happened the first time I saw it, and I came back to see it again, and then that one also started late, so by the time I was finishing, then I was kind of like bumping up to the next session. And so, but I did get a chance to do the offboarding a little bit of talking to the AI, and sometimes with large language models, it could be very inquisitive and ask questions forever, and I didn't know if there was an endpoint to where it was going, but I was kind of just following it in the moment. But just love it if you have any comments on LLM as an offboarding process.
To be very honest, this is a little bit of an experiment for us. The Bell Girl was always a guide that we wanted to have there, but the idea of bringing it as an AI was something that kind of came in as an interesting experiment, because when you want to potentially scale this project to have, let's say, several modules and have it in a bigger space where you could have more people through, this feeling of having something live, a live component, real-time component, becomes harder to do with live performers just for the sake of how much it would cost or to handle. So like the idea that you could have an AI that potentially could do some of that emotional labor or like performative labor could be interesting, and so we're testing it. I think it still needs work. It does a good job to some extent, but as you said, like, it doesn't really have a natural way of sort of concluding your conversation. It just kind of keeps going, so we have to pull people out. Most of the time, they don't want to leave, which is nice, but it's also, it's like we have to get the next audience in, right? So it has a lot of potential, and I see it also as a potential of something you could use in the onboarding or throughout the experience to sort of create these pockets of interaction or reflection that you could have with someone. So yeah, I really want to work more with that as a concept further on.
Yeah, and finally, what do you each think is the ultimate potential of XR and immersive storytelling, and what it might be able to enable?
That's a classic question. I think it's very clear. If you haven't been around this world, you probably wouldn't see that, but if you've been just a little bit around this world, that these stories are amazingly impactful, can be very impactful, and have a unique affordance of embodiment into a story that can really be transformative. We've heard it time and time again, and it just keeps being the case. So if XR actually sort of meets its potential in terms of reach and distribution, then it can be a massively transformative medium for the world.
Yeah, I agree with the transformative perspective. I think it's so interesting that you have this possibility to actually create environments that you can explore on your own, and also in the same time be following a storyline. I think that you're following that storyline in your own sort of agency is just creating a level of investment for the audience that holds a tremendous potential. And also the fact that you can also start playing with social codes, because how is the choice of one audience affecting the other audiences? So it also becomes like the negotiation of how we deal with all kinds of social interaction, that you actually take that kind of thing that is going on all the time around us, but you can integrate it and put it on, like frame it and put it to a more specific use and play with that inside these worlds.
Right. Anything else left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
Go see Dark Rooms when you have the chance, and let us know how far you want to go.
That's it.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll enjoy the piece, and I feel like it's this intersection of documentary and kind of immersive story. It, like I said, it felt like I was going through a dream, and the way that you created this journey that kind of led to the next spot, and having two other people at the same time and having X's on the ground to have us know where we go. But yeah, just the transitions that you have from going one of these areas to the next was just really elegant in a way that you're preserving a certain continuity of being in a spatial context, and, you know, with some teleporting and cuts, as it were. But yeah, overall just felt like a really compelling journey that you're taking us on, but also all the stories that you're telling. Really quite enjoyed it. So thanks again for joining me here on the podcast to help break it all down.
Having us, and this is going to be fun to see what's going to happen.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage, and hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals, and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so I really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also, it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself, so please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.